Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Guess who I am? I'm Richard Dugan. Of course, I'm the host, and I like coming your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Almost did that in one breath. We do stream live at those times at richarddugan.com. We also podcast the programs at the radio show's page, at SoundCloud, iTunes. We do have a Facebook page and a Twitter account, and we are excited about this particular program. You're going to want to take notes. You're going to want to listen to this interview in its entirety. And what I mean by that, of course, is that sometimes these interviews go on and on because there's so much, I kid you not, to talk about. And this is very exciting. Now, my special guest here on the program is a very extraordinary man in his own right. And he has written a rather extraordinary work as well. And we're going to be talking with this gentleman. His name is Brian C. Wilson. He is the professor of American religious history in the Department of Comparative Religions at Western Michigan University in the United States of America on the planet Earth. He is the author of other books such as Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and The Religion of Biologic Living, as well as Yankee in Michigan. But we're going to be talking today about the quest for the new age. John E. Fetzer, I believe that's how that's pronounced, Brian. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
John Fetzer. Now, I have been a metaphysician for, well, since I was 17. That would put it at about, I guess, 40 years almost. A little over since I was 17, maybe even a little earlier than that. And it is entirely possible for an individual to live out their entire life searching and investigating and practicing all kinds of stuff and never hear of certain people. And I have to be honest with you, this is the first time I have been introduced to this particular gentleman, John Fetzer, and his quest for the new age. I will tell you that at one time in my career, I worked for a Christian radio station. And of course, I'm sure you are very aware, the last thing they want is the new age. The New World Order, of course, is a whole nother conversation for another time. But to me, this gentleman is fascinating. And I have to say, we're going to jump right in here, but I have to say that folks like him, they remind me of people like Edgar Cayce. I've read a lot of his books, and he was a devout Christian. He was committed, and yet he still did the kind of work that he did that is in all of these volumes that we have at our hands today. And other people as well who had these belief systems that were just, they were very, shall we say, fundamentalist, if you will, in their belief. And yet, I mean, there's another gentleman by the name of Johannes Graeber back in the 30s who wrote a book called Communication with the Spirit World of God, or the Spirit World, I should say. And he was a devout Catholic priest. And yet he got involved in this whole channeling thing. And I remember my mother reading the book. I gave it to her to read, thinking that she would be very interested in it. She didn't like the book. She read it, but she didn't like it because at that time where she was at as a Catholic, didn't care too much for the criticisms of the church. But, that's certainly changed over the years. So this is fascinating. And in addition, he is right up my alley because I'm trying to figure out when the radio was first invented. And I know it wasn't Marconi. I've actually learned that in history, just because we live in America, we primarily get the American inventors who, I guess, get the patents first. But I think, I want to say it was a German or a Belgian who actually first came up with the radio, but bringing it full circle here, John Fetzer, his career, a majority of his life was spent in radio and then television and cable. I mean, he's been in the broadcast industry most of his life.
That's correct.
And he was dealing with what we would consider a metaphysical medium. I mean, if you think about it, the broadcast industry is a metaphysical medium. Because the signal that you get, our listeners are listening to now, It's going through the ethers. You can't see it. It's beyond the physical.
Mm-hmm.
It may be created with physical apparatus and then received in kind. But the actual signal, you know, and I can only imagine what the aliens and the rest of the universe are surmising from the transmissions that we have been sending that are emanating all across the universe. It's incredible. But first of all, tell me about yourself. Now, first of all, I'm always intrigued by talking with people who have been studying, especially comparative religions. And I have to say that working for the religious radio station, I considered myself a student of comparative religions, because even within Christianity, you have all those all the different sects and all of the different constructs and doctrines and dogma and beliefs and so on and so, and rules and regulations. How did you get involved in all of this? What is your upbringing that it seems to me like you've got to have a certain level of open-mindedness to even look into some of these others? Because, again, as I said before, 15 years, I worked with a lot of people. The last thing they want to do is even think about the fact that there are other belief systems that could serve them even better, because this is what I was born and raised into, and damn it, I will die with the same belief system. So tell me, how did you get started in all of this?
Well, it's an interesting story, because I was nominally raised a Presbyterian, and my parents weren't very religious folks, and so I didn't have much of a religious education. And in fact, at school, at college, I was planning to become a doctor, and I majored in medical microbiology. But at the end of that, I decided I didn't want to go straight into med school, because I really didn't have enough kind of real life experience. So I joined the Peace Corps, and that's the thing that really reoriented my life in fundamental ways. They sent me to Honduras for a couple of years and to the Dominican Republic. And so I was in a very different cultural environment, and I got very interested in Roman Catholicism and the varieties of Roman Catholicism. In Honduras, there was the added kind of attraction of the Maya. I was stationed very near Copan ruins, so I was able to spend a lot of time exploring those. And so ancient Mayan religion became a fascination of mine. And then in the Dominican Republic, I was sent off to a little cane town off in the boonies, and it was half Dominicans and half Haitians. And they were all Roman Catholics, but the Haitians were also practicing forms of voodoo. So being in the Peace Corps really exposed me to a wide variety of worldviews. And when I came home, I decided to abandon my desire to go to med school and to study religion instead. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 20 some odd years.
Wow. And yeah. I have to say that I've had a lot of different people who, you know, come from a lot of different perspectives. And some of my favorite conversations have been with rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
Because from, again, I only know from what I've gleaned over the years, the level of education and study that is required to get to that level, to become a rabbi, is just unbelievable. I mean, rabbi should be followed by PhD. It just should, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, too, that there were a lot of us who are curious. And I consider I consider myself a metaphysician, one who believes that there is much more than just the physical world, that there are things beyond the physical that we're trying to understand. We don't yet, and we're working on it. And there are people who have delved into this. Now, there is an interesting television program that's on right now. It's called Strange Angel. It takes place in, I believe it is the 50s, late 40s or 50s, after the World War II. And it's the process of developing space program, initial delving into. And then there's the subtext, there's this cult that's going on in this thing kind of thing. And supposedly also there's this underlying message throughout the program, each episode, about going after what you want and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, John Fetzer, apparently he found a connection. And I'm curious as to his leanings in that, as far as his upbringing. Was there something in his childhood, or was there a catalytic event that propelled him forward into believing that one day, and I think we're, if not there, we're getting close, one day science and spirituality would maybe not coexist, but maybe even merge and become one, that one would validate the other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there was a pivotal experience, and that was when he was first introduced to radio. He had a brother-in-law who was a telegrapher for the railroad, and got interested in building crystal sets. And this was way back when radio technology was very primitive. And so John Fetzer and his brother-in-law, Fred Ribble, got together and they built a crystal set and started listening in to the voices and then music that came over the airwaves. And for John Fetzer, this idea that, as you were talking about earlier, these kind of non-empirical energies, these radio waves flying through the air that you can't see, it was a technological marvel, but I think it was also kind of a spiritual awakening for him, because he really thought that there must be something at the end of the electromagnetic spectrum that shades off into other kinds of subtle energies, if not spirit. So I think that's kind of the catalytic point. His introduction to radio got him thinking about these larger metaphysical issues. He was actually raised a Christian. He was baptized a Methodist, and as a teenager, his mother converted to Seventh-day Adventism, and he followed her into the church. And so throughout his 20s, he was a very devout Seventh-day Adventist. But at the end of that time, he felt a real need to go out and explore other things. And I think it all traces back to that kind of pivotal moment where he kind of discovered the existence, the possibility of these subtle energies that would lead him on to a greater kind of metaphysical existence.
You know, this John is someone I would love to know, not only because of his involvement in radio, especially in the early days. Mm-hmm. I have to say that in 1980, when I was going to broadcast school, it was one of those vocational schools, six-month things. I think it was about $3,200, mm-hmm. A pittance in today's standards. Went to go take the third-class license test, and we were told, oh, you didn't hear? Well, 2 weeks ago, the FCC deregulated certain elements, and the third class is gone, which I was very disappointed because I really wanted that certificate up on my wall. Sure. In a frame, because of all of my predecessors and all of my peers at that time who had the third class license. Oh, yeah. All I have is this little box top. But the thing that also strikes me about him, the other thing that I really like about him, is the fact that obviously, he loved the game of baseball, because in his later years, he bought and was the sole owner of the Detroit Tigers. And I'm an avid baseball fan. I don't care who's playing. I'll turn it on and I'll watch. And mm-hmm. and we have here in Santa Barbara, for example, a semi-pro college team called the Santa Barbara Foresters, who, by the way, just won their seventh NBC World Series a title, unprecedented. It's a record breaker. Wow. And they had a record-breaking season, a record-breaking postseason. It was just unbelievable. But I love the game, and obviously he did too. That's why he bought the Tigers. And obviously, yep. I'm sure it was for business reasons too. But he also had some incredible advisors. As a matter of fact, I noticed that he has, there's reference in, I believe it's chapter 9, referring to a psychic advisor or counselor, if you will, dealing with channelings.
Mm-hmm. No, he believed implicitly in the possibility of channelings. And throughout much of his life, after he began his metaphysical quest in the 30s, he was always seeking out mediums and psychics and channelers. And for example, during the 1960s, he was great friends with Gene Dixon. And then late 70s, early 80s, actually early 80s, he came into contact with Jim Gordon, who is a channeler and psychic. At that time, he was working for an organization called the Coptic Fellowship of America. That's how John Fetzer met him. And Jim Gordon then became kind of John Fetzer's house psychic. Fetzer would consult him on a variety of different matters, both in terms of business, but also in terms of what to do with his foundation, which eventually became the Fetzer Institute. And so Jim Gordon became a large part of his life and a very important advisor in that last decade.
Mm. He actually, there's also a website I'm going to steer people towards. It's called infinitepotential.com. Now, apparently John Fetzer believed that the planet could be transformed by loving action. And through the exploration of the connection between science and spirituality, he engaged in his own, as we're talking here on the program, broad and deep spiritual search. And during his lifetime, funded Leading Edge Research at Stanford, Duke and Princeton. And let's see, his story also exemplifies his quest to wake up to infinite potential. And he's quoted here as saying, "I feel that we are on the threshold of a new order where people will be seeking enlightened change. This will all come about with the infusion of spirituality into science." So spirituality into science. One of the things that always struck me as interesting, Brian, is this idea that if I can only find enough evidence to support my belief, then I can get other people to believe it. Mm-hmm. Well, my first problem with that is that most philosophies, and I put the religions in this category. Now I refer to them more as philosophies than I do religions. If they're faith-based, there isn't a solar system's capacity to hold evidence that would be relevant, because we're talking about faith. Faith has nothing to do with evidence. Faith has to do with believing. You choose to believe certain things. Now, Even I would have to say that if I was to, and I'm not going to, but if I was to pound on the countertop that's sitting in front of me, I would say, "Hey, I don't believe that that's a hard surface. I know that it is." But then science tells us that it's not, that it's made up of energy. But it's just very densely packed. But it's still just energy. And it's almost as though these rules that we supposedly understand about the universe, every year we rediscover new rules that almost obliterate the old rules, saying, "Oh, now we've got all the answers." And then the next year we come up with new rules. Yeah. We have new discoveries that tell us, this whole thing with, I'm sure that you've heard about, for example, dark matter. Yeah. And I've had conversations with people and they say, "Well, we know that it's there, okay, but we don't really have any instrumentation to verify its actual existence." But based upon mathematical equations, high-end, beyond my, over my head kind of mathematical equations, we can prove mathematically that dark matter, okay, exists. And I'm thinking, okay, but actually the mathematical equation is telling you dark matter exists, so you choose to believe the equation. So really, the existence of dark matter is more of a belief, in my opinion, than it is an actual fact, because there's nothing tangible there. But then when you start getting into metaphysics and this whole aspect of spirituality, has this research into John Fetzer's life changed your belief systems? How has it shifted you in your spiritual life and or quest?
Well, people often ask me what my religion or spiritual path is, and I kind of jokingly say it's comparative religion, because I think of myself as something of an agnostic seeker. Mm. So on the one hand, I'm very attracted to these things, and that's why I basically, when I came back from the Peace Corps, decided to study these things. I went to UC Santa Barbara and got a PhD in religious studies.
Ah.
Yep. And So there's an attraction, but there's also part of me that basically says, okay, well, I want to take a kind of critical approach to this. The fun thing about the John Fetzer project was he was into so many different metaphysical traditions and currents and read so much that for me, it was eye-opening, just the variety of things out there Now, there are some key ideas that kind of tie everything together, but the variations of it are just remarkable. So I think for me, it's been a kind of intellectual expansion that there's a whole kind of tradition out there in the United States that isn't, you know, Jewish or Christian, but something different that has been in this country since the founding. And it's been a powerful tradition that's taken just a variety of different forms. The other thing that really intrigues me is that I was born and raised in California and moved out here to Kalamazoo, Michigan in 96. And I was a little bit trepidatious coming to the Midwest because I didn't know what it would be like religiously. And it turns out that there's a whole metaphysical subculture out here that stretches back to the 19th century that's just absolutely fascinating. So for me, the Fetzer book has just kind of expanded my worldview in the sense that there are all these different metaphysical possibilities out there.
I think that's one of the things that partly intrigues me as well, but I'm also quite intrigued, and I'm curious as to John's perspective on this, and that is the whole aspect within spirituality as well as other areas of ritual and ceremony and even tradition as a part of one's, shall we say, practice. I mean, you might have these beliefs, you might have these philosophies rolling around in your head and heart, but at the same time, you can't just have them rolling around in your head and your heart. You kind of have to do something with them a little bit, you know,
That's right.
To keep them stirred up, so to speak, to keep them
That's
active.
Right.
So what kind of ritual traditions and or ceremonies was he involved in his spiritual walk?
Well, that's a really interesting question because I think one of the things that John Fetzer really enjoyed in his childhood Christianity was the service. And then when he left, that was something he kind of left behind. Through a lot of his search, it was very intellectual. It was based on reading and you know, talking to various people. But then as he got older, got into his 70s, during the 1970s, he really decided, okay, if I'm going to do this, I need to put it into practice. And so as in his 70s and 80s, that's when he begins to develop kind of the ritual side of his worldview. The first thing he did was during the 1970s, he got very interested in transcendental meditation and became very good friends with the Maharishi Yogi and basically advised him on radio and TV and other media and began practicing transcendental meditation. And in fact, in the 1974 spring training for the Detroit Tigers, he offered the Tigers classes in TM, and some of them took it and really enjoyed it. So meditation in some form then became his principal practice. In the 1980s, he got into the Radha Swami tradition, the Suryat Shab Yoga meditation tradition, and was very interested in kind of the American variants of that, like a Kankar and the movements for spiritual inner awareness. And so he basically practiced those forms of meditation until literally the day he died. And then another thing that was tremendously important for him in a ritual context was that he found it very important to have a kind of metaphysical community, friends who were interested in these things, and he could talk to them freely about them. And so in the 1970s, he created something called the Monday Night Group. And this was a kind of metaphysical group that got together and they read parts of various channeled documents like the Urantia book or the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus or A Course in Miracles. They then actually listened to the channelings of Jim Gordon, his house psychic, and then discussed them. And this group, this circle, this Monday night circle, was really instrumental in not only forming a community for Fetzer, but also helping him formulate what was going to be the ultimate mission of the foundation he created, which eventually became the Fetzer Institute.
What is it about Mr. Fetzer? And you've written about other folks as well, but why him and why now?
Well, a variety of reasons. I'm very interested in the way individuals put together their worldviews, and especially alternative worldviews. So my previous book was on John Harvey Kellogg, who is a Seventh-day Adventist, and we know him now, of course, because he invented breakfast cereals. But he also had a very interesting spiritual life, and put together a really interesting, in some cases, troubling worldview. So I found that fascinating. The Fetzer Institute actually has a branch called the Memorial Trust, and their part of their mission is basically to preserve the legacy of John Fetzer and kind of get the word out about John Fetzer. So they knew my work, and they invited me to write a spiritual biography of John Fetzer. And the interesting thing about Fetzer is that he collected everything. So there's a huge treasure trove of books and documents and pictures and letters in the archives of the Fetzer Institute. And that allowed me to do a really very rich portrait of his evolving worldview pretty much throughout his entire life.
Wow.
So that's the thing that really attracted me.
Well, I have to say that you described yourself in this day and age more as an agnostic, and mm-hmm. quite honest,
well,
I have to some degree, and I would have to say that that's probably the more honest approach. Because years ago, when I was in my 20s and thinking that I knew it all, someone said to me, "Do you know it is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than mm-hmm. to begin in certainty and end in doubt." Mm-hmm. And I try to share that philosophy with people who have taken a staunch position on something. Mm-hmm. That's not to say I haven't since then, but I remind myself, you know, okay, yeah, you're leaning hard and fast on this particular one. You're holding pretty hard, pretty strong to it. You might want to let loose just a little bit, because mm-hmm. something may come along to undermine that whole thought process you've almost laid in concrete.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're very different people across the life cycle. You know, we're very different people as children, as adolescents, as young adults, as adults, and then as seniors. And the interesting thing about John Fetzer was that he always kept evolving throughout his life. And even in his last decade, when he had all sorts of health problems and other obstacles, he maintained this kind of curiosity, this openness to new things and to new practices. So that's something I think in my own life I'd like to emulate. I'd like to keep my mind open and be receptive or at least tolerant of new things, and to explore them in a kind of honest and open way. So I'm in the best profession, I think, to do that as a professor of comparative religion.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I absolutely, and I'm lucky to have connected with you and being able to glean what I can from you. I have to say that one of our programmers at that station that I was at, his name was, I'm sure he's long since, he was old then, so I'm sure he's passed on. Clyde Freeman was his name. He had a program, and it was a program focused on Thus Saith the Lord scriptures. And he and I used to have fascinating off-air conversations, just fascinating. And he would only discuss, belief and, the whole Christian doctrine and dogma, as long as it was based upon passages from the Bible where God was speaking, whether it was through Jesus or in the Old Testament where you knew God was talking.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. And one of the things he said to me that also has stuck with me, he says, "My mind is closed to the point that it remains open to consider to consider other people's ideas. I'm willing to do that." And I thought, wow, that's saying an awful lot, because I ran into a lot of other people who basically the phrase would end right there with, "My mind is closed."
Yep.
Period. Fascinating stuff. Brian, I want to thank you for staying with us. We're going to take a short break. Brian Wilson is my guest, and we're talking about John Fetzer and the quest for the new age. Also, another aspect of John's life, as we've been talking about broadcasting, Brian, is, of course, his involvement in broadcasting from quite literally its infancy. To see and be a part of, literally a part of, the development of the technologies that, in one sense, that we have today. It's just because I remember when I first started in broadcasting at that religious station. That wasn't my first job, but it was the first job I had where I actually worked at the transmitter site, not more than maybe 70 feet from the tower, not more than 6 feet through a wall from the transmitter. Okay. Some people say that I worked there for 15 years and they say, well, that explains an awful lot about you. but anytime there was a problem with the station, I had to jump on my bicycle, which is how I got around then, ride the, I forget how many, 4 or 5 miles to the station to fix the problem and then bicycle home. Now, I literally can sit in the comfort of my bed while I'm sitting there watching TV. If I get an email from someone saying, hey, there's a problem at the station, or a phone call, I can actually log on with my phone to the computer at the radio station, usually to fix whatever the problem happens to be. So, you know, we've come a long way. But we're going to continue talking here with Brian Wilson. And again, the title of this particular work that he's put together is John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. We'll continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Brian Wilson, and we're talking about Johnny Fetzer. Brian, I'm not even sure how to phrase this question. I know the question I want to ask. Why is John Fetzer so important that he needs a tome to describe his life and experiences and so forth, from your perspective, as opposed to somebody else who's maybe got a, because as I said, I mean, I'm familiar with a lot of names and in both broadcasting and spiritualism and metaphysics and so forth. And this is, I'm grateful that this is, that I finally heard of this gentleman's name. But why him?
That's a good question, and there are a couple of reasons why. One of the reasons is his life and his spiritual quest really mirrors that spiritual quest of millions of Americans during that time period. I think John Fetzer was a little bit before the wave. He got into these things before they became public and popular. So I kind of describe him as a proto-New Ager, as a person who kind of heralded the New Age movement in the 80s and 90s. So for people wanting to learn about metaphysical traditions and their history in this country, and especially in the Midwest as well, John Fetzer's life is a good place to start. The other reason is that John Fetzer was extremely wealthy. Before he died, he was on. He was one of the 400 richest people, in the United States, according to Forbes magazine. And what he did with his money was to create an institution to basically carry his spiritual vision into the future, and that became the Fetzer Institute. And the Fetzer Institute is a thriving institution today that is doing all sorts of interesting work in the spiritual realm. And for people who want to kind of learn the background, the what led to this interesting institution, this book will provide a kind of introduction and a good explanation for why the Fetzer Institute does what it does.
Mm. And what does the Fetzer Institute do besides house all of his worldly possessions, those wonderful documents, which, by the way, I have to say that the older the material is, the more reliable I find it. When I found Johannes Graeber's book, A Communication with the Spirit World of God, that was written in 1933. And the book copy that I had, I wish I still had that copy. I do have a copy of it, was printed, in this case, it was printed on, I guess, the onion paper.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it was, and it was a magnificent read. It's a thick book. It took me, me and my wife, months to read it, but it was fascinating. So to me, because back then, in the early part of the 20th century, but even going back to the latter part of the 19th, you, in spite of the fact that there might have been objection to, you know, these concepts, mm-hmm. as I experienced in the 80s in my religious radio station experience, you didn't have people who were trying to necessarily destroy all of this stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and then try to rewrite history and so forth. I mean, I jokingly say in regards to, for example, the story of Mary Magdalene and how I say, man, she should be getting, you know, kudos left and right. And how in the world did they manage to mistakenly leave into the Gospels her experience of first meeting the Christ, mm-hmm. who she knew who it was. She was the first person, as well as woman, to recognize who he was. Even when the apostles came upon him, they didn't recognize him. And yet they left that in there. And I'm thinking, oh, that, I think that was a mistake. You should, because of what you were trying to push, you shouldn't have put that in there. But anyway, mm-hmm. That's why I trust older materials, more so than necessarily newer ones, because, and you're dealing with, you were dealing with primary source information, mm-hmm. from these writings. Tell us, go ahead.
Primary and secondary. I mean, one of the fun things about doing research on John Fetzer is that he read and collected just tons of metaphysical books over his lifetime. One of the first things he did when he left Seventh-day Adventism is he went down to Indiana to a spiritualist camp called Camp Chesterfield. And in fact, he kept going down to Camp Chesterfield to consult with the mediums until the 1970s. And they still have a metaphysical bookstore. And so John Fetzer said that every time he went down there, he would come back with just armloads of books. And these were preserved. So most of his library, going back to, to the 20s and 30s, there are all sorts of tomes and books and articles and magazines and things down there that really take you back into the early part of the 20th century. And the thing you learn is that there was a thriving metaphysical subculture in the United States during that period, going even back to the 19th century. So this stuff has been around for a while. So that was a real treat, being able to read his library.
Yeah. I always find it fascinating when I read even earlier history, for example, of the founding of this country, and even prior to the mid-late 1700s, when the Puritans came over here from England to escape Henry's wrath and so forth and lack of freedom, that then they began to exhibit the same kind of restrictions and, mm-hmm. and all of that kind of stuff on their own people, let alone the indigenous peoples that were already here before we got here.
Yeah.
It's like, excuse me, do you understand? Do you understand what you're doing? You're violating the same civil rights, if you will, or human basic human rights mm-hmm. that you said Henry was violating in your case. And the same kind of thing in our day and age when I hear about these protests on various university campuses where an individual of a particular philosophy has been asked to come speak and many, many students who are not of that philosophy are opposed to it. And yet the very philosophy of that institution is freedom of expression of ideas, the free exchange of ideas. It's like, wait a minute, why is that not, you may not like this person's philosophy, but I thought this was about the free exchange of ideas.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree entirely. I think, colleges and universities should be zones of free speech where people can come with serious ideas and talk about them, even though maybe a great majority of people, you know, don't agree with them. Shutting people down that way, I think, is a really bad idea. Yeah. But some ideas, like these metaphysical ideas, are kind of irrepressible. They have been basically shut down in the past, repressed, but they always seem to pop back up. And in the history of the United States, you find that these metaphysical ideas keep popping up no matter where you are, in the East Coast, the West Coast, the Midwest. So it's interesting how ideas themselves will keep kind of popping to the surface and intriguing people.
And the thing that people don't seem to remember is that you can get rid of the individual, but once the idea has been hatched, born, blossomed, whatever, once the idea is out there, that's almost impossible to get rid of. Because mm-hmm. there's always yeah. going to be a small group of people who are going to hold on to that idea. Mm-hmm. And and so you can never really completely get rid of the philosophy, the idea, and so forth. It's always going to be there. And in one sense, you know, you say here, John was on the quest for the new age. Mm-hmm. And some would even say that actually it's not really that new. I mean, this has been no. sought after for centuries.
Yes. Well, the interesting thing is he came out of Seventh-day Adventism, which is an apocalyptic group. So these are people who are looking for a kind of new age, the millennium. And so for John Fetzer, he kind of transmuted that into more metaphysical terms. And so this idea for him was always that individual spiritual transformation. If you got enough people to be transformed, that would lead to a kind of global spiritual transformation, a kind of elevation to a higher level of consciousness. And yeah, that idea of the new age has been around for centuries. I mean, it's an old idea that takes new forms. Again, it's another one of these irrepressible ideas that keeps popping up in a variety of different forms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms and maybe what we should do next, and both from your perspective as a professor of comparative religions, as well as from John's perspective, because mm-hmm. they very well may be different. What is the new age? What is it that we're? How mm-hmm. will we know when? Mm-hmm. Will there be signs on the highway? Now entering the new age.
Probably not. No, John Fetzer really believed that, again, if enough people follow their spiritual path, and he had this idea of freedom of the spirit, that everybody should follow whatever path they're attracted to. And he was kind of a perennialist. He believed that all the paths would eventually lead to the same kind of spiritual truth. But he believed that if this were encouraged, then it would kind of catalyze a larger kind of spiritual transformation of the world. And for him, it was all about peace. It was about prosperity. It was about tolerance. We'd enter into a new global age of heightened consciousness that would allow people to live with their differences in ways that were fruitful and created the greatest degree of happiness on earth. He didn't think this was going to happen overnight, but he had this very deep conviction that spiritually we're entering into a transitional phase. And he used the term New Age. Now, today, of course, people are labeled New Agers who have a kind of shallow spirituality. But for him, it always meant that individual transformation was not enough. It was always about the community. It was always about the global spiritual transformation. And he never lost sight of that. And that, in fact, is part of the mission of the Fetzer Institute.
And your particular philosophy, if you will, or understanding of the New Age, is it similar?
Well, yeah. I guess I'm a little bit, I have a greater kind of wait and see attitude. It's hard to see in today's environment, considering the state of our country and the state of the globe, what the ultimate, you know, whether the ultimate transformation will be positive. I certainly hope so. I certainly have a great deal of hope that human beings will evolve to another level that will allow them to, you know, be on this planet for a millennium to come. But I guess I don't have that degree of spiritual conviction that John Fetzer had. But, you know, got to keep an open mind, got to keep a positive thought. I'm certainly hoping for the best.
And I too, and then I raise this question. I'm curious if you are able to, dive into the information you have from John. John, I hope you don't mind my calling you John. Mr.
No, I'm sure not.
Mr. Fetzer. Was he an optimist, or did he think that somewhere down the road there was going to come a break point, as many people have been talking, of course, over the last 15 or 20 years, you know, that we're on the precipice, you know, we're almost to the point of no return as far as our own extinction, that maybe, and I've raised this question, and it's more of a pessimistic nature, although I'm a very optimistic person. Do you really think that man deserves to continue on as a species? Look what he's done. He's just not, collectively, just not done a good job of taking care of his home.
Well,
And his fellow human beings.
Yes, yes. But I think for John Fetzer, he was an incurable optimist. He really believed that despite the challenges,
After World War II and what happened in Germany and all of that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he, just at the end of World War II, he was invited by General Eisenhower, along with other radio executives and some journalists, to go tour Germany and kind of get an idea of what the situation was in terms of the radio industry there. And at a certain point, he managed to get his way into Hitler's bunker in Berlin. And at that point, of course, you know, it was just at the end of the war, it was in shambles, and it was, so he kind of entered the heart of darkness. And even that experience didn't erode his optimism. And despite the challenges of World War II, and despite the challenges, he was very concerned about what was going on in the country during the 1960s. He wrote about this in an essay called America's Agony. But still, he was tremendously optimistic that human beings would be able to get it together. But he always thought the solution was going to be not a material science, but a spiritual path, if not a spiritual science. So for him, his optimism never died.
I don't know if you're familiar with a gentleman by the name of Jacques Fresco. He developed a civilization, a futuristic civilization called the Venus Project. One of the core, there were three basic pillars. One of those pillars was that this was going to be, this new civilization was going to be a resource-based, not an economically based, but resource-based society. In other words, the resources would belong to all the people. You'd still need distribution centers to distribute whatever the resources were, but they wouldn't own them. They wouldn't control them. They would distribute. And so I was talking to him in a couple of interviews that I did many years ago, and he has since passed away. But I asked him at the end of our first interview when he was 94, and I says, so do you see this possibly happening in your lifetime or mine? He says, well, probably won't happen in mine, he says, and it probably won't happen in yours. And at that time, I was, I think, in my late 40s. And I says, well, why not? You know, I mean, I like the idea. It sounds great. It's sort of a utopian kind of thing. He says, he says the very thing that you've talked about with John Fetzer, and that man has not raised his consciousness to a high enough level to get beyond the daily minutiae that we're currently dealing with. In order to live in that kind of civilization, that we have to get to that point anything like that will ever happen. And I got to tell you, I want to stay as optimistic as possible. It's one of the reasons I continue to do this program after 11 years. Yet, you know, you look around and going, oh, I don't know. I don't know. It's like someone just lit the fuse and it's about a half inch away from the bomb. And, you know, and yet I want to be optimistic and say, you know what, we've got to try. And it sounds to me like through everything that, and again, the history that Fetzer lived through, now he was just a teenager, during World War I, wasn't he?
Yes. Although he, almost passed away because he got the Spanish flu.
No.
And that was a turning point in his life too, because he had been despaired of. He was incredibly ill, and of course, the mortality rate from the Spanish flu was horrendous. And he overheard the doctor basically saying that he wasn't going to make it. So he basically made a pledge to his creator that if he were allowed to survive, he would basically devote his life to some kind of greater good. So even though he was, well away from World War I geographically, he felt its effects in terms of the Spanish flu.
Then that's also something I'm sure that he tapped into as he progressed throughout his life, and that mm-hmm. was the effects on his personal life and being of the events going on in the world.
Yes, yeah. Very definitely. And of course, being in radio and broadcasting, a big part of that was the news. He was always exposed to things that were going on. And during the 1930s and 40s, he spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. for a variety of reasons. So he was kind of at the center of power. Got to know a number of different power brokers like FDR and Truman. He knew what was going on out there. He knew the trend of the world, where things were going. But again, he felt that if we could only catalyze this spiritual transformation of the world, then humanity would be able to survive.
What was his desire? What was his desire for a legacy? What was it that he mm-hmm. either wanted to make sure he left behind for future generations that he wanted to be remembered for? And I've often found that people of a spiritual nature, they don't really care about being remembered. They want mm-hmm. to make sure that the next generation can have have it better than they did. Not that mm-hmm. they had it terrible. I mean, I look at John and I'm thinking, wow, that's a pretty incredible life. Could I borrow that life for a while? Uh-huh. That's pretty neat. But at uh-huh. the same time, I'm sure there were aspects of his life where, he had to think in terms of what kind of legacy am I going to leave behind? Mm-hmm. What were his thoughts on that?
Yeah. He was tremendously successful. He made millions. But the money was always, it weighed heavily on him. Because he felt that just simply making money wasn't enough. So there always had to be a mission, a reason for the money, some kind of goal. So when he got into his late 70s and early 80s, he began to systematically sell off his business and businesses, including the ball team. And he used that money to endow his foundation, which is now the Fetzer Institute. And what he hoped the Institute would do would basically promote his kind of spiritual vision, including this idea of freedom of the spirit, but also have some very practical kinds of projects. So actually, in the beginning, he was fascinated with parapsychology. So the foundation, the Institute, funded research in parapsychology. And then as he got older and infirm, he got very interested in alternative medicine. And so he began funding all sorts of projects in alternative medicine, including he was one of the early funders of biofeedback. And then when he passed away, the Fetzer Institute decided to go a little bit more mainstream, and so it began funding research in alternative health through the National Institute of Health and things like that. And also it was alternative health education. So one of the things it funded was an early Bill Moyer special on the power of the mind to heal. And that was a tremendously successful series of programs. And then more recently, especially after the events of 9/11, the Institute is really focused on how to promote love and forgiveness throughout the world. And so they promote a variety of different programs to encourage spirituality throughout the life cycle, so for children and for seniors. And then a relatively recent project that they've been working on is to use spirituality as a way of getting people together to talk about democracy, talking about the spiritual roots of democracy. And the whole hopes there is that we can overcome the kind of knee-jerk divisions that the nation has fallen into by delving down to kind of the spiritual core of our democracy. And hopefully we get people talking across divides instead of shouting across divides. So those are the kinds of things that John Fetzer really hoped his legacy would be. And I think the Fetzer Institute has done a wonderful job in basically honoring that.
I would have loved to have met this man. He sounds like an incredible individual. You know, he's obviously was alive in my early days in broadcasting back in the 80s. And it would have been great to have come across him in just some simple conversations. But he had a rather extraordinary conversation and experience, if I am correct, with Jesus in an elevator.
Yes. Yes, another one of the turning points. He was a young kid, and he was basically playing in an elevator in a department store in small town Indiana, and kind of got himself into trouble in the elevator. And he had a kind of visionary experience. He looked up, and he was basically holding on to the leg of Jesus, and Jesus looked down at him and said, "I'll never let you go." And I think that's the root of kind of his spiritual conviction that, you know, this is true. There is a transcendent realm out there, and to some degree, you're being supported by it. So that was a powerful, almost mystical experience for John Fetzer that he always talked about to people who he trusted as one of the foundations for his spiritual quest.
Fascinating. I remember reading in the Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East, I want to say book 3, I guess it was, where they entered this cave where they met Jesus and Pontius Pilate and several others. And I remember, and I highlighted this in my copy of the book heavily, because it was so profound when they were talking with Jesus and he was expressing his pain and sorrow over the fact that he couldn't commune with men because they'd put him so high up on a pedestal. And all he wanted to do was be among them and be with them and be friends. And just like you and I are conversing and having a great time, that's all he wanted. And it broke his heart.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because John Fetzer loved those books, Baird Spalding's Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East. Parts of those books really became a blueprint for John Fetzer's life. And you mentioned Jesus. Even though John Fetzer left the church, he never stopped being a Christian of some kind and would always talk about Jesus and talk about the availability of what he called the Christ consciousness. So yes, he had that very kind of close personal connection to Jesus throughout his life, regardless of the kind of metaphysical path he was on.
Yeah. I have to tell you that I don't know why, but for some reason I have a lump in my throat and tears in my eyes right now because it's just extraordinary that here was a man who. He had what seemed to be a silver spoon in his mouth, which isn't necessarily the case, but he sure built one through the years as the technologies improved from the 20s and 30s and 40s into television and again cable, and now we have the internet. His passing, when did he pass away?
Well, he died in 1991. He almost made it to his 90th birthday. And the interesting thing about that is that several months before he passed away, he made the decision. He had set up the Fetzer Institute, set up another foundation called the Memorial Trust, which is in charge of basically preserving his legacy. And he moved to Hawaii. He felt that the Institute was strong enough to survive on its own. And so he decided he was going to avoid the Michigan winters and move to Hawaii. And there, in his last months, he continued his spiritual practice. He lived next door to his channeler, Jim Gordon, and it was just a remarkably wonderful time. And he'd achieved a real kind of calmness and peace. And so when he finally passed away, there was nothing really sad in it. It was, as he said, it was just simply a transition to a higher energetic level, as he put it. Even his passing, I think, is an interesting model for people to think about.
I'm curious, is there a record by anyone of his final words spoken before his passing?
There are. He was in the hospital in Hawaii at that time, and he was with his channeler, Jim Gordon. And together, they were practicing a meditation tradition, Shirat Shab Yoga. And that entails basically saying a series of mantras. And so as he died, he was reciting the mantras. Now, of course, the mantras are private, so we don't know exactly what they were.
Right.
But right until his last breath, he was following his spiritual path.
Because I know that it is reported that Gandhi's last words were, "Oh God."
Mm-hmm.
And some have interpreted that in many different ways. Oh God, how could this happen to me? Or he was calling out God's name because that's where he was headed. But I have to say, just more recently, there's a gentleman who passed away after having what I consider to be an incredible music career. And it is said that the last words from this gentleman, who I'll tell you who it is in a moment, his last words were these four. So much wasted time. David Cassidy.
Uh-oh. What a shame.
And I grew up watching that guy on the Partridge Family. Mm-hmm. My very first record album I ever bought was a Partridge Family record. But it's interesting, the final words of individuals who depart, who, as I like to say, mm-hmm. transition.
Yep.
And I want to read real quickly here. It's a very short quote from John Fetzer that, you know, it's amazing the connections. There are no coincidences, Brian. I call them coincidence.
As we go
through my life story, you're going to find that the word search is one of the paramount activities of my life. I've been searching all my life. Closed quote. And I remember sharing that concept with someone when I was in my mid-late 20s, and I was sharing with someone that, yeah, I'm on my search, to which they said, and this was at that religious station, the Christian station, they said, well, once you find Jesus, your search is over. And something inside me knew that wasn't true, and I immediately said, actually, once I find Jesus, my search has just begun. and I've been searching ever since, and I'm hoping that mine is as fruitful as John's was. I have an unbelievable library of books, and I've got journals that I've written, and I'm in the process of finding a way to preserve and protect them from these blasted wildfires as long as I live in California,
mm-hmm.
Or digitizing them, which is, I guess, what I ought to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's this whole aspect of our beingness that both John and you, because you're the one here talking with us today,
mm-hmm.
You continue your search through this whole aspect. I mean, yeah, you're a teacher, you're a professor there in Michigan, but the teacher is both teacher and student. And I'm curious from
sure.
your perspective about the students that come through the classroom that you are in and teaching each day and each week and mm-hmm. each month and each year. What kind of philosophical perspective are they coming in with? And are many of them walking out with with a broader perspective, as opposed to what's the accusation is today, that the majority of the higher institutions of education are all left-wing liberal indoctrination centers, and that we've got to, and I'm sitting here, and I made the comment, says, well, where the heck are the right-wingers? Why aren't they opening up their own colleges? But again, this also goes back, and so I'm curious about that, as far as these mm-hmm. students coming through mm-hmm. your classroom. What's your perception before, and what's the before and after picture from your perspective?
Well, we get a wide variety of students taking the classes. Some have a very committed religious path that they're on. They belong to a church or a mosque or a synagogue, and others come in and they're interested in kind of a general way in spirituality and religion. And then we get other students who are just simply taking the course for course credit. And all three are absolutely welcome to the class, because my goal is to not judge the traditions I teach about, but to learn how to understand them. And so if somebody has a very firm religious commitment and they come to my classes, they shouldn't be concerned that I'm going to indoctrinate them or try and convert them or convince them that they're wrong. That's not the point. But through comparative religion, you can actually learn a whole lot about your own tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping those students who leave the class, even if they haven't changed their mind, because that's not the goal, will have a kind of enlarged idea of not only kind of the spiritual possibilities of the world, but also about their own tradition. And then for those who come in with kind of a vague notion, it's just so much fun to introduce them to the variety of things that are out there. It's almost a kind of aesthetic joy to look at the varieties of religious experience, to coin a phrase. And students get very excited about this. And what's really fun is if you get a student who's just simply taking a course to fill a requirement, and then they come up to you at the end of the class and they say, hey, I really learned a whole lot, and this has broadened my outlook and my perspective, and I appreciate your non-judgmental approach to these things, then that's a real win. That's one of the goals in teaching, is to open a student's eyes to just the varieties that are out there.
I wish we could incorporate your philosophy into the minds of other instructors, other teachers across the post-secondary realm and the other areas as well, because I know that there are people out there, there are people in the classrooms who are trying to indoctrinate. They are actually actively trying to convert mm-hmm. people to whatever their philosophy is,
sure.
whatever the subject is. And it's like,
sure.
wait a minute, that's not, see, that's why I find, even though I would never go back and sue my grade school or high school for malpractice, because I didn't get the education I would have liked, because since then, I think I have my PhD. I just don't have a piece of paper mm-hmm. to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
Through these interviews, especially. But I wish that I had learned about all of these other philosophies that were out there. I wish that mm-hmm. that I have a feeling that we would have a whole different perspective on the other religions and even the conflicts that are going on around the world between peoples of different belief systems.
That's right.
If we, in grade school and high school, learned about these, I think that we would be taking a whole different tack in terms of our approach to whether it's Zen Buddhism, whether it's Shintoism, whether it's Buddhism, Muslim, the Muslim faith, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and the list goes on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other aspects that I always found fascinating when people would talk about Christianity, and again, in that 15-year cycle that I was in, was how it was the be all and end all. It was like, okay, yes, there are millions of different foods you can eat and drinks you can drink and careers you can go into and educational institutions you go to study, places to live, people to associate with, but there's only one way to God. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me?
Hmm.
That doesn't make any sense. My brain cannot wrap around that because it makes no logical sense. And then the other thing too is that they make this assumption that their particular philosophy somehow grew out of a vacuum. That mm-hmm. does not happen. It does. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. It came from something else before it. So
well,
there's an evolutionary process, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, I'm a historian of religion, so I always take a historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we look through time. How do these traditions change and evolve through time? And that's always eye-opening to students. As you say, a lot of students kind of feel that, you know, this stuff has come on high and it's eternal. But you can look back through the historical record and see how religious and spiritual traditions have changed and evolved depending on human needs and other things, which is tremendously eye-opening. It's very difficult to kind of see your tradition as a kind of unchanging monolith after you've looked at it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that we could probably go on for another hour conversing about all of these different things and getting your insights. Are there any particular, and again, I'm using my word here, particular philosophies that, though you may not be a follower of it,
mm-hmm.
that they are intriguing to you, that like you're top two or three? Are there, because of what they teach, because of what they have to offer the devotee, shall we say?
There are several traditions I could mention that I find just absolutely fascinating. My work on John Fetzer introduced me to theosophy and the varieties of theosophical traditions, which are just incredibly rich and have a very highly developed kind of theology and cosmology and soteriology. So I find that tradition just very attractive and very interesting, just because how it's been developed. But I'm also becoming very interested in kind of America's homegrown spiritual movement, transcendentalism, going back to the 19th century and to the father of American spirituality, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I've been going back and reading his essays and finding just a great deal to think about. It's very poetic and it's not easy reading, but if you can kind of penetrate the way he thinks, there are a lot of interesting and useful ideas beyond kind of the caricature of Ralph Waldo Emerson that we have today. So those are two traditions that I find just tremendously interesting and exciting.
I want to throw something out to you real quick before we wrap up. What can you tell me? I have a copy of a book of the history of this person. And the author of this book, I was going to interview. And unfortunately, from the time that we began to try to set up the interview until this particular event, the event was she passed away. I was so upset about the fact that I could not interview her about this particular person that she'd written about. And we're talking about a thick book here. But what can you tell me? And maybe we can do a whole interview on this. What can you tell me about Madame Blavatsky?
Oh, well, she's a fascinating, fascinating character. She was born in the Ukraine, Russian by birth, and at a certain point she realized that she had a variety of psychic abilities. She entered into an early marriage that was not happy, so she left home and traveled. And we don't exactly know where she traveled, but she claimed she went to India and Tibet and there met a series of ascended masters. And then she went to Egypt and for a time was a medium in Cairo, and then came to the United States. And she was attracted by the presence of spiritualism in the United States. And here she met a Civil War colonel, Henry Steele Olcott. And they both shared an interest in not only Western esotericism, but also Eastern philosophies, Hinduism and Buddhism. So together, they got together in New York City and founded the Theosophical Society. And the idea behind the Theosophical Society was that it was going to study comparative religion and encourage spirituality and the brotherhood of man through spirituality. Blavatsky then went on to write two major texts, Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. And if I were to pick probably the most influential metaphysical text of the 19th century, it would have to be The Secret Doctrine. And these are partially channeled texts that just describe just a vast kind of metaphysical cosmology and soteriology that is just really very interesting. So she was just a fascinating, fascinating figure.
Yeah, I was, because I knew nothing about her at the time when this book was given to me, and I was really looking forward to that interview.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, well, so now I'm going to have to find me a channeler who can channel this woman who we can have a conversation from that perspective, which would be one for me.
Madame Blavatsky would have appreciated that.
Or maybe we could channel Madame Blavatsky.
Who knows? Sure.
What about the philosophies, the difference between the philosophies that have, shall we say, a messenger of God, i.e. Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Baha'u'llah, as opposed to those that have someone who, through their own research and study, like a Madame Blavatsky, or I'm trying to remember the person who put together A Course in Miracles off the top of my head.
Helen Schuckman.
Thank you, Helen Schuckman. Or these individuals, they founded these kinds of philosophies, but they weren't necessarily deified by their adherents that of their mm-hmm. or their disciples, if you will. Is there in the context of comparative religions, is there a difference from your perspective between those two, shall we say, aspects of a philosophy that are out there today?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, not all the world's religions, of course, have founders. Hinduism doesn't have a founder. Shintoism doesn't have a founder. So a tradition can develop in very rich directions without actually having a central figure. One of the things I think happens is that in traditions that don't have a central figure, you get all sorts of interesting ramifications, developments in the tradition that you might not get otherwise if people are fixated on a founder. Yeah. You mentioned A Course in Miracles, and that's absolutely fascinating because Helen Schuckman channeled these materials from Jesus or Christ consciousness. And she herself said, you know, I see them, but I don't believe them. And she really did not want to be the founder of a new tradition. So she was very, very reluctant about the whole thing, in part because I think it it would have implications for her privacy, and she just simply did not want to take on that role. So even though it technically has a founder, A Course in Miracles, you know, it's not dependent on the life of the founder because the founder eventually kind of repudiated her own or her channeled teachings, which I think is just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
But today, given, you know, our modes of communication, the internet, the way we can actually communicate, things will spread very fast. And so I think the way new religious movements form in the modern period, and especially in the 21st century, is going to be very different from the way they form in the past. And again, does it matter if there's a founder or not? That's an interesting question. I can't give a definitive answer.
I know that in many instances, a lot of the times, the founder tends to get in the way. They focus more mm-hmm. on the messenger than they do on the message.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
Just incredible stuff. Yeah, maybe we will set up another time to talk
sure.
about Madame Blavatsky. I'll pull up the book and I'll tell you the title and the author and so forth and give you, of course, you probably already have all the information necessary in that regard. Obviously, as you say, this is one of the categories that you like, you enjoy, that is intriguing to you, the Theosophical Society and the Theosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Off the top of your head, roughly, and let's just say that are in the mainstream, how many different philosophies would you say that there are? And as I say, in the mainstream, that most people, even if they don't follow it or have ever read anything, they're familiar with the name kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 20, 30, 40, 2, 3, 4?
No, I think it's much more than that.
Hundreds?
I think it's probably, maybe over 100.
Yeah.
It depends on, you know, just how aware people are and what their sources mm-hmm. of media are.
Mm-hmm. And even the ones you've mentioned, too, that deal in the whole, shall we say, the dark magic, the voodoo and like mm-hmm. Santeria and stuff that goes on down in New Orleans.
mm-hmm.
And in
or
the
you were talking earlier about Jack Parsons and the Ordo Templi Orientis, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, and Freemasonry,
yeah.
And
yep.
I mean, there are just so many that go by. And I also understand, though we can't really get into it right now because we need to wrap things up, but that mm-hmm. John Fetzer was also interested in UFOs.
Oh, very much so. He
now,
was absolutely fascinated.
When did that happen? Because obviously in the 70s and 80s, if you said anything about belief in UFOs, you're a nutball.
Well, it started actually. He was an assistant radio censor during World War II.
Oh, wow.
And so he was hearing stories about Foo Fighters, you know, over the, they were following Allied planes over in Europe. And so that kind of piqued his interest. And then, of course, after 47, with the first big UFO incident, he just became fascinated. And during the 1950s, he read just about all the UFO literature out there. Of course, that's still in his library. And he continued on. And the one thing, there's a social club he belonged to in Kalamazoo, and they met at a local institution called the Park Club. And the one time he spoke about his metaphysical beliefs is he gave a very long lecture on the reality of UFOs. And I'm sure that was an eye opening for his friends, because they had no idea he was interested in this. But the UFOs basically connected the kind of cutting edge, unorthodox science he was interested in, along with a lot of the kind of spiritual themes. A lot of the early UFO contactees were actually theosophists. They come out of the theosophical tradition. So there are these interesting connections. So Fetzer was, yeah, absolutely fascinated by the possibility of UFOs.
Oh, just, I mean, it's just incredible. And this is just one guy. And by the way, when you're talking about Madame Blavatsky in particular, as well as some others, or no, it was Shukman. The first thing I thought of was, just like Edgar Cayce, you know, he just resisted and resisted and resisted, didn't want to do it, and yet he still did. And there are books that talk about that. I mean, I've read his books. Yep. I've read Ruth Montgomery's books. Mm-hmm. I'm a Reiki master. I've read Joy's Way and learned that there's more. There are more than seven chakras in the human system. I've been a part of a wonderful group. Back in Phoenix, when I met my second wife, they were actually training and practicing Tai Chi and all these different movements and energy things with a gentleman by the name of Sunyata Saraswati, who was also, I believe, a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. Paramahansa's book, The Autobiography, is my metaphysical primer that I came across at the age of 17. Which would have, 1977, and I now have it on my phone, and I listen to it, you know, on and off pretty regularly. Another one of my favorite books by a gentleman by the name of, I believe it's James Banner, is called The Impersonal Life.
That was a favorite of Fetzer's.
Oh my God, I have that. I actually have. It was given to me on my 21st birthday. And I read it so much that the binding broke. So I took it to a print shop that did bindings, and they put it on a spiral, one of those spring spiral deals. And now, of course, I can lay it flat and all that kind of stuff. And I carry that with me almost everywhere I go. The woman that gave it to me says that if she were ever trapped on a desert island and were asked, what one book would you take with you? That's the one she would take with her. And I've read that, and I have that on my phone too through Audible, and just, I mean, the list just goes on. And I mean, we all have these incredible libraries, and boy, the study and research that we're just trying to understand. I don't have all the answers, and I have to say, early in my career, I used to work for a station that was broadcasting the Larry King Show over the Mutual Broadcasting Network. And I was working the weekends. And the one thing, in addition to his love of baseball and stories he would tell, was the fact that he always, when people would talk to him about religion, he'd always answer them as, I'm an agnostic, because I don't know. And honestly, that is probably the most honest response that any one human being, regardless of whether or not they've, you know, taken on that label of Christian or Jew or Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out. It's, again, better to begin in doubt and end in certainty. And that's what we're trying to do here. We lay out this smorgasbord, and you've taken up a big area on the table here, I want you to know, which is wonderful, because we want people to go to that table and take what resonates with them and walk away and check it out and test it out and go to the various links that we will put on the website and then hopefully come back and try something new.
Sure.
You know, we're not, you know, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful of anybody's philosophy or where they're coming from. Just trying to say, hey, consider the possibilities.
Yeah.
And John was able to merge his spirituality into his business life. And look what he created and leaves behind. It's amazing. Yes. Brian, I hope that we can have you back again.
I'd love to come back.
Brian Wilson's been my guest. And Brian, I want to thank you so much for taking, again, so much time to talk about Johnny Fetzer and the quest for the new age and all related topics, of which there are a whole bunch of them. And I want to extend to you, if you ever want to get out of Michigan for a while, come out to the West Coast, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation face to face.
Great. I'd love to come back to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Know the place well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. And before we let you go, I've been giving out one or two websites, one in particular, the infinitepossibilities.com.
Actually, infinitepotential.com.
Infinite Potential. I don't know where I got that one. Infinitepotential.com. Mm-hmm. We'll send people to that website. We encourage you to investigate, research, whatever it takes, whatever you feel you need to do, to also find out more about John Fetzer and the work that he did over his lifetime and the things that he was curious about as well through the book, John Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. And before we let you go, three final quick questions. The first is, because you are our guest, who is Brian Wilson?
Well, I think my principal kind of identity is as a teacher, as somebody who kind of makes the world available to my students.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Tolerance and understanding.
And what is your life's purpose?
Well, this would probably be easy if you asked me just at the last minute of life, I would probably know. But at this point, my life's purpose is to basically educate and prepare my students and my readers for engaging in a wider world.
Brian Wilson, thank you again for joining us and for sharing with us not only your life, but also the life of John Fetzer and the quest for the new age. It's just been a fantastic interview. Thank you.
My pleasure. It's been great.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.